years back when we, as ministry, started talking about making three conferences out of one. So we looked forward, we thought about, we prayed about. It seemed to me like if we walk with God in doing it, on the other side of having it done, we should be able to fellowship like one big conference, but organizationally function as three. And I'm just so blessed to sense that. I was blessed to come here Friday night in your bishop ordination that other week. And just such a blessing to, from what I sense, to feel the warm fellowship like as though we're one. And may God help us to keep that. But you know, as time rolls forward, the next generation won't have walked through this like we did, and then how will they look at those things? Well, that's what our message is tonight, the title, Combating the Generational Gap in the Church. Time moves on, children grow up, and you know, I've sensed this already and mentioned a name like Brother Aaron Shank, and there's a growing number of people who are like, I don't know, Aaron. And that's just the way God works. In that time, we each serve God in our period of time. And then when time is over, God has someone else that fills the place. And time continues to roll forward. So, combating the generational gap in the church. The word combating means to oppose or to resist, to work on it, to push back against. I think the choice of that word is correct, because I believe that in reality there always will be some difference between the generations. And this focus tonight, this message is tonight, is how can we keep it from being too great? How can we keep it from being detrimental? How can we keep it from being that which would destroy or go the wrong direction? So, what is a generational gap? Well, it's a difference in opinions and values and beliefs between younger and older generations. Between values and beliefs, between perhaps communication styles and preferences. We often, in our day-to-day, we talk about technology use. There's often a difference between generations. Social norms, things like the work and family balance, or work, recreation, and family and church balance, and putting that all together. That varies sometimes between generations, how that is looked at. I recently, well, maybe it tells on my age, but I've had several conversations about this concept of the rising generation and how the older generation sometimes looks at the rising generation. And this older man told me, he said, well, you know, the generation today, the only reason they have a job is to support their habits for Friday night through Sunday night. They come to work Monday through Friday so they can fund their recreation for the weekend. Well, so a generation gap, social norm. Sometimes this generation gap is seen in worldviews, how we look at the world and see things. Many times it's seen in work styles and communication and motivation in the workplace and how that is done. There's probably numerous other places that it would show up, but there's the places where sometimes it is clearly seen that the older generation handles it this way, and the younger generation, because of whatever influences, because of whatever a number of things happening, they look at it differently and they approach it differently. We have a salesman that comes into the store regularly. He represents the Orgill company, where we buy the majority of our hardware for the store, and he's a couple years away from retiring, and he's been a good salesman. So helpful, and you always get answers, and if he doesn't have it, he gets you to the right place to get answers. And we went through some tough waters, as most places did, through COVID and getting up supplies and things. And Tom was right there, and he did everything we could. We stuck with him because of our salesman. I asked him the other day, I said, so who are they going to replace you with when you retire? Who are they going to replace you with? And he admitted that he worries about that because he just doesn't see in the younger ones coming on, the younger hires, he just doesn't see what he wishes to see. He's a Christian, professing Christian man. But we talked about that. And then he talked about the fact that they're hiring more ladies. And he knows that a number of our Mennonite shops, we don't want a lady salesman. We want a man salesman. And so generation gap, as time moves on and as the older ones who did well move on, how big a gap is it between? And that's, we're talking about that story that's set in the world, but how about in the church? How big a gap? What kind of things happen there? We might raise the question at the outstart, why be concerned about this? Should think a little bit about it. Why even have a message on this? Let's just let life dictate and let's just roll with the change that time brings. Well, one of the reasons I think we should be concerned about this is because of this simple statement, simple truth, that the bias of nature is toward the wilderness. And things left to themselves get more wild and less orderly and move away from godly principles. And that happens in our experiences. That can happen between generations. You won't find that left to themselves, the next generation will rise and shine in character and strengths over the former generation. It goes the other way, left without direction. I remember as a boy, my grandma Benich, she was part of the United Zion Church in Reinholds. I remember her. I remember she wore a covering, at least for church, and many times even during the week she would have a covering on. But that was rapidly changing in the United Zion Church, and many were not keeping that. And so the United Zion Church has moved away from much of that and has apostatized. Again, the bias of nature is toward the wilderness. It's toward going downhill and leaving principles. And so then about, I don't know what it was, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, when I was driving bus regularly, I was asked to drive for the United Zion Church at Reinholds to take them on a mission trip to Bowery Mission in New York City. And I was kind of excited to do that because I got a chance to see United Zion Church. Well, first off, it was all old people that got on the bus. There was no young people. Oftentimes, trips to New York City involve youthful groups to go and sing, not this group. And I realized that they don't have young people. The young people left them. It is only old people. Now, the two men that were in charge, and I didn't know if they were pastors, one was older, and he was dressed like I would expect a pastor to be dressed, and the other man was dressed in a t-shirt and short pants. And I just figured maybe he's like the missions coordinator or whatever. It turns out he was the young pastor. And listening to them talk, he apparently was somewhat new to the congregation because the older pastor, they were talking about it. And they were catching up on the history of this congregation. And they talked. Little did they know that a conservative Mennonite bishop was driving and eavesdropping on what preachers talk about in the United Zion Church. And they covered a lot of subjects. But one of the things that I found intriguing was they got talking about churches that split and splinter. And the old pastor, this is set in Lancaster County setting, the old pastor said he has watched for years how Mennonites split and splinter because they pay too much attention to little details and it always equals a split. Later that day, as we were sitting in New York, I went into Bowery Mission to see how they do service, and that younger man was up front preaching in a t-shirt and shorts. He was preaching deliverance through Jesus Christ. He was preaching from the same Bible that I preach from. And I had all kinds of thoughts going through my head about, well, what do details mean? What do details mean? And remembering my grandma and seeing that none of the ladies that day had coverings on and the preacher was in short pants. And you see, that by nature, we're tipped to go that direction. It doesn't have to go that direction, but that's why we need to talk about generational gap. Well, biblical truth and good values can be lost over time, is the point of that story. Can be lost from generation to generation. And oftentimes when it is lost, then that generation is lost. That's what happened there. The young people weren't with them anymore. This book is eternal. Truth is fixed. It leaves no room for sin and complacency. Life may change and change drastically, but this book doesn't. Right is right and wrong is wrong. Another reason why we should be concerned about this is that hard lessons learned by one generation can be lost in the next generation. And so our older folks among us who were part of the generation that came out of conference and came out of those apostatizing churches, they know something about the pain of forming a new church because the other was losing it. And for many of us, we don't know that. We've had good church life. And so some of those lessons at times are lost with the passing of a generation. Another reason I think we should think about this is that mission drift is a real thing. Mission drift is a real thing. So what is the purpose of congregational life? What is the purpose of something like Pilgrim Bible School? What's it to serve? And sometimes as years go on and go by, sometimes we can lose our focus and the focus can shift to something that it wasn't intended to be or include something it wasn't intended to include. And so these are all reasons why we should think about what's happening between the generations. Is a gap happening? Is there pulling apart? Is there going different ways? I also raise the question, when does it become a problem? Well, I believe it becomes a problem when communication breaks down between the older and the younger. It's a good thing when younger folks can stand in church and visit with older folks. My father-in-law gave testimony that he likes that after church it's common for the young fellas sitting just behind the older folks to stick around here and visit and talk with the older men. That's a good testimony. That's a testimony that something right is happening on this subject of this generational gap. So if communications break down, if there's little or no interest in the other, or when relationships become broken between generations and they just can't get along, when the influence from the aged stops and they don't want to hear it, they want to make their own decisions, when the younger disdain the old ways. Turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 6, verse 16, for an opening verse. Jeremiah 6, verse 16. This is set in an era of time when Israel was apostatized, and God, through Jeremiah, was speaking to the children of Israel. He wanted to restore them. He wanted them brought back. Verse 16, thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the ways and see and ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk therein. Now, I must clarify that it's not true. It's not always true that older is always better. What Jeremiah was talking about was the old faithful way of truth, God's way. And holiness and righteousness. And we have a tendency, because of we're given to nostalgia, we have a tendency to think that the old days were the good old days. But if we were forced to return to that for 1 month, and exactly that way, we'd cringe. It's fun to talk about the good old days. But this, Jeremiah was talking about returning to God and those good ways. And he says, return to those ways. Your fathers knew something. There was a time when you had it, and you don't have it. Return to those. Look, you seek that path. And they said, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. Well, another thing I thought about in introduction, I don't know if you've ever read or heard about, I believe it's called the Chesterton's Law. Chesterton's Law says that you're not qualified to change something if you don't know why it was there in the first place. For example, if there's a fence and a gate, you buy this property, there's a fence and a gate, or there's a right-of-way somewhere, a dirt road somewhere, and there's a gate across the road. You say, let's get rid of this gate. Well, you need to look at the question, what was the gate put there for in the first place? It is easy sometimes to remove gates and never realized what problem that opens up to. And I believe that when it comes to spiritual things, I believe when it comes to church life and the values that we've appreciated, I think there's some value in, first of all, understanding what was good about it. What did it do for us? Why was it here before we quickly changed something? Because sometimes after we change it, we realize what it was there for. And then we wish maybe that it was back. And it is very, very hard in life, especially church life, to put something back the way it was before. When a gate is opened, it's almost never closed again. That's been my experience. Maybe some have, but it's very tough. Go with me to Psalm 78, another passage. I was glad for what Brother Alan read tonight. Psalm 78. Psalmist has a number of times when it talks about God's people, talks about families, talks about generations. But here in Psalm 78, I want you to think about how much the people, how quickly the people moved away from God and got into things. How quickly some kind of gap became between what they appreciated under God's blessing and where they went with their carnality. Psalm 78, verse 1, give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing them to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. So this is a commitment that we will tell our children. For he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. And then if you go down to verse 17, we should read this whole passage, but 17, and they sinned yet the more against him by provoking the Most High in the wilderness, and they tempted God in their heart by asking meat for their lust. Yea, they spake against God, and they said, can God furnish a table in the wilderness? Go down to verse 22. Because they believed not in God and trusted not in his salvation. This is the people of God. This is the people who were part of this wonderful beginning of telling them to their children, and this is what they did. Because it's so natural for us to do that. Verse 32. For all this they sinned still and believed not for his wondrous works. Therefore their days did he consume in vanity and their years in trouble. When he slew them, then they sought him and they returned and inquired early after God. And they remembered that God was their rock and the high God their redeemer. Nevertheless, they did flatter him with their mouth and they lied unto him with their tongues, for their heart was not right with him, neither were they steadfast in his covenant. But he, being full of compassion, forgave their iniquity and destroyed them not. Yea, many a time turned he his anger away and did not stir up all his wrath, for he remembered that they were but flesh, a wind that passeth away and cometh not again. How oft did they provoke him in the wilderness and grieve him in the desert? Yea, they turned back and tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. They remembered not his hand nor the day when he delivered them from the enemy. It just goes on and on and on. This is a passage to tell the children what experiences the fathers had. It's to tell the children that, you know, we believed in God and he delivered us miraculously, and it wasn't long and we were lusting after the stuff back in Egypt and we were in trouble, and then we were thirsty and we forgot God and we didn't trust him, and then God brought affliction to us, yet he was patient, he didn't destroy us. And then we turned back to God and then soon we forgot God again. And this is the story going to the generation and the next generation, that The story of history is, it is so easy for us to go away from God and forget him and fall into God's condemnation. Well, let's think about some ways we can combat the generational gap. How can we combat this generational gap? And there's probably, I'm sure there would be more things we could talk about. I think I have 7 things. Encouragements for us to push back against and to bridge up and have the faith maintained from generation to the generation and not be like the children of Israel. Well, ways we can combat the generational gap. Point number one is it must start in the home. I believe that this problem of a generational gap first starts in the home. And I know that might lay a heavy burden on parents' shoulders. But I've seen that if parents fail to embrace the doctrines and practices of the church, but consider themselves exceptions, and they don't have to do it, or children grow up learning that parents do this, catch me if you can. Look, I want to tell you something. In the kingdom of God, there is no such thing as catch me if you can. Because God has everybody caught on candid camera all the time, and he knows everything. There is nothing like that. That's a myth. That's a fairy tale. But if we live that kind of life, we set the stage for children to walk away from God, to not value the doctrines and practices. If children are not taught to hearken to authority, children must learn to listen. If they have never, and sometimes we say, well, they must have their will broken or however you want to say it, but they must learn that when dad says no, it means no, and I must yield. If parents side with their children against other authority, you set the stage for this huge gap between generations, and you set the stage for apostasy. You set the stage for the next generation. You set the stage to lose them completely. If parents... I will speak plainly, but if parents dress their children like they know the church does not allow the youth and adults to dress, you set the stage for a generational gap. You really do. I was recently talking to a brother, and he said, you know, it's almost amusing to me, but it's a burden on my heart, he said. I don't know what words to use. It's amusing to me that parents doll up their children, and then when they get to be teenagers, they wonder why they don't appreciate what we have as a church. He said, it makes perfect sense to me. You send them there. You put it in their heart. And he said, you know, when I was a boy, I wanted to be a cowboy. And my dad wouldn't let me dress like a cowboy. He wouldn't let me have boots even that were work boots that kind of were the slip-on like cowboys wear. He wouldn't let me wear cowboy things. But he said, one time I was at my cousin's place, and he had cowboy clothes, and I slipped in cowboy clothes, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and he said, what happened that day in my heart was when I saw myself in cowboy clothes, I loved to be a cowboy more yet. And he said, by then I was getting old enough that he said, I started to realize that, you know what? If I walk around in cowboy clothes, I'm going to love to be a cowboy all the more. It's going to, what I put on is going to feed, and it's going to grow. He's a wise man. In a faithful church with a faithful family who's endeavoring to do his best to have the children be like the parents. I believe that homes where parents are good friends with the ministry at church, homes where father and mother enjoy visiting in the minister's house, bishop's house, eating popcorn around the fireplace on a cold winter night with the preachers. When children grow up in homes that's the relationship between parents and their authorities, that you won't have much of a generational gap. You'll have a bond there. You'll bring them along. There'll be a respect. There'll be an interest. There'll be a willingness to heed. There'll be more cohesion. Children that can visit with adults and enjoy adult stories. I don't have to always think we got to be away on our own and playing our own thing and doing something. Children who learn that adults are not boring. Adults have some things that we can learn and educational. And I think it's a challenge for us adults when those occasions, when we have those occasions, whether it's after church or whether it's in our homes where, you know, young people are sitting in listening, I think it's important that we ask questions about their lives. What are they doing? Their work? What do they enjoy? And maybe tell stories from olden days of our youth, that things that we did that they connect with, and not just, you know, when preachers are together, we tend to talk about preacher stories and challenges. But we have a part as adults in crossing that gap and involving our youth and children. And so the home is so important. Number two, and I don't have these in any order of importance, but number two, I believe the Christian day school is a huge part of combating the generational gap. It shapes their worldview. I raise this question tonight, and I don't have the answer. And I'm glad I don't know the answer. I'm pretty certain the answer is a really, really dark answer. But I raise this question, where would the church be tonight if our children had to be in public school the last 10 years, the last 20 years? All the children growing up were going through public school. Where would your church be? Where would our church be? I think the answer is a pretty dark, sinister answer of we should be glad. And I know we're fixing to start school, and I know it takes a lot of energy to clean school, and I know it takes a lot of money to raise the money to support the school and all that, but I want to tell you something. The cost of sending our children to public school way outweighs the cost of what we have in this blessing. And I just like to encourage us, because I think that's a huge thing that we maybe don't even realize how much it impacts that. We do right now in this little minute while we're talking about it, but when we're laboring to pull the school together and do school board meeting and all that, sometimes we can get a little soft on this. And so, Christian day school. Teachers that embrace and model what the church believes and appreciates. I think this is important. Often we have young sisters and brethren teaching, and it's important that we're careful what kind of role models we put in front of our children. Curriculum that is God-centered and Bible-based. And that, see, they're, as they learn, as they study, they're getting a worldview. I remember many years ago when Rod and Staff came out with their U.S. history book. Our conservative publishers over the years, the early years, struggled to do a good job of history and science. And some of the Becca and some of those places seemed to pull it together. They had more finances quicker, maybe. But I remember when I got a hold of the U.S. history book the first time for eighth grade and had the opportunity to teach that. And I loved the way that book is set up. Because every period of time, you had maybe in a chapter covering this period of time, you had maybe two sections on where were the American people? Where was the country? And then you had a section, where were God's people? That was beautiful. I loved that. It was easy to teach. Because I didn't like a book that had God's people strewn all through the country. Because there is a country, there is the government that's ordained of God, and there is that whole function, and then there's God's people, and we're separate. And it made it so easy. You could teach about the politics that were going on, and the president and all that, and then, but this is how it impacted the church, and this is what was going on, and this is how God's people faced war, and those. And I just say that to say, those things are huge in shaping worldview, how we look at this world around us. And so curriculum is God-centered. Godly character insisted on in everyday living. Can't have filthy talk in the school. Can't have improper boy-girlfriendship stuff going on. Can't have those bad influences coming in. We must take a stand. Christian standards of dress and influences upheld. I believe that in a real sense, our teachers stand in a very important gap between the older generation and the younger generation. And in many ways, our teachers, especially our upper grade teacher, has more power on this subject than the preacher does and the bishop. And so there's a challenge. Upper grade teachers, take your place and love the Lord and the church and fill it. And that's why we have boards in place to help guide some of those things. But let's use wisdom, because it's an important part to play. All you need is a teacher in there who is questioning everything the church does and planting seeds of doubt and living in such a way that says, catch me if you can, and it doesn't really matter. Pointing out the inconsistencies maybe that he thinks he sees in leadership and that kind of stuff, and you'll lose the next generation. And it happened right in your classroom that you were raising considerable money to support this whole thing, and it was undone. Number three, I believe that preaching and teaching with children and youth present is important. This kind of service with the children here. And I know that sometimes when folks get older and they need those hearing assistant things, and sometimes, especially the older models, maybe the newer ones don't do this, but when there's noise like children in a church, it can really be wearisomeness to older folks. And I've had more than one older person tell me that if the subject could ever come up about having children's church during the preaching sermon, have the children out and have their own little lesson so that they wouldn't be that noise in the church, I would vote for it. And I say, no, no, we need the children here. They need to experience this. And we need to preach in such a way that keeps their interest to some degree. I know they can't understand everything, but we need to be able to preaching and teaching with children along and experiencing it, learning to sit in church. Sunday school classes that are meaningful for our children and our youth. Again, where would the church be without something like Sunday school and those lessons? A number of years ago, quite a few years ago, a man from an old order setting was coming through Shepherd's Fold. And as he was ready to graduate and go back home to his family in another state, he asked me a question that stopped me in my tracks that I had never thought about. And we had a family of quite a number of children, and we're doing family life and family worship. And he asked me, he said, what plan do you follow in family worship so that you cover all of the important subjects that children should know before, by the time they're of age to become a Christian, or, you know, 16 or something? What plan do you follow so that you get all the important subjects covered? And I never thought through that. And it got me thinking, what am I doing? But you know why he was asking that question? He was set in a church setting where they don't have Sunday school. And they don't. And so a lot of it fell to the home and to the father and to family worship. And so I walked away from there saying, well, we actually should think about what all we're doing with family worship. But praise God, we have so much of this other teaching around. And maybe we've taken that for granted. But the point is, children need to be with us in church services. And church services need to have things for the children that they can learn. We should welcome loyal questions from our youth and from our children. From folks who want to do what's right and they're committed, but they have questions. We ought to answer them. I want you to go with me to 1 Kings chapter 12. Here's a principle that the old men knew. They had it right in their generation, but the young men scorned this principle and didn't follow it. 1 Kings chapter 12, this is the story of Rehoboam asking advice. How shall I do? The people are asking that I would lighten their load from what Solomon had laid upon them. 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 6. And King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived and said, how do you advise me that I answer this people? And this is what the old men said, and it is spot on. It is biblical, and it is proven to work. They spake unto him, saying, if thou wilt be a servant unto this people this day, and wilt serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be thy servants forever. That's a lesson to church leaders and to fathers. If you will be a servant and serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them, That's the formula for people to be committed and to walk with you, because they get answers. One of the most frustrating things for people in business is if they ask the employer and they don't get an answer to their question. Or in church life, if they have questions and it's just like, that's the way we always done it. And don't ask any questions. You're out of your place to ask. We need to have this humble spirit. These older men were right. The younger men said, no way. Tell them that your little finger is going to be thicker than Solomon's thigh. And he whipped you with whips, and I'm going to chase you with scorpions. And they went on. And what happened? Do people serve a king that takes that? No. Do people stay with a church that rules with a rod of iron? No. That's how you empty out the place. Preaching and teaching with children alone. I believe that one of the points in this point is that we need to be consistent in applying truth. We need to be consistent in how we apply truth. In other words, if the old men can drive luxury cars because old men have the money and like the finery of a big luxury car, but we crack the whip and the young men can't have a sports car, they'll see right through that. And we actually create a generation gap the other way around, in that we allow carnality for the older and get harder on the younger. And so consistency in applying truth. And this thought that as a church and as a family, we need to think seriously about professed values and acted upon values. We have a certain amount of values that we talk about that we have. The question is, do you actually do it? Do you act upon it? When there's a large gap between professed value and acted upon value, you turn the next generation away. You cannot bring them along. You can't bring them along. Now, sometimes because we're human and we falter, sometimes there's a little gap there. It's something that we need to work on. And be sure that what we teach and we preach, we live and act upon it. And I think that maybe there's times that if we're ready to preach something and we realize we're a little weak in doing it, but this is a burden on my heart and I believe the scripture teaches it, maybe we ought to pause on preaching that message and work on doing it for a while before we say it. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. In this generation gap, it doesn't work because the young people, the next generation, soon sniff it out. I've been asking different older folks preparing for this message. This message kind of caught me a little. It was a little tough to pull thoughts together. And so I was asking this morning at Blue Ridge, after where we had a fellowship meal, and I was asking some men, so you're older, tell me what. And one brother told me, he said, one thing that I learned, he said, I don't quite understand it, but one thing that I learned is you cannot fool the next generation. They see right through your consistency or inconsistency. And if you act like you're not inconsistent, that's a double whammy. He said, when they see right through it and point to it, you got to say, you got me. We need to work on that. If you say, nope, you just see it wrong, whatever, they're gone. They're gone. You just offended them twice. Well, preaching and teaching with children and youth along. Congregational life, studying the Word of God, bring them with us. Number four, mission endeavors with adults and youth together. I believe that one of the ways that we cross this generational gap is to work together in mission endeavors and sharing the gospel. Things like New York for Jesus, things like handing out tracts, visitation, working together where the young people can work together with the older ones. I believe that school teaching provides an opportunity for youth to lead under the leadership of a principal and the board. And there's a place of laboring together. Shepherd Fold counselor gets experience in working with needs. And there, you know, young men get involved in something that's bigger than them. But this book is sufficient. And the answers are here for the needs. And there is a labor. And there's house parents. And there's the director and that kind of interaction, there's some real good things happen. But not only that, those are all like special church functions. There's some things that are out of the way that often don't get noticed. Things like for our sisters, simply helping a busy mother with house chores is a tremendous place where the generational gap is crossed. learning to cook and bake and learning how they do it. I remember growing up, we grew up on about 9 acres of land. We didn't really have a farm. We had some goats, but there wasn't a lot of chores to do. And so my dad was always concerned that we would have something to do. And so we often helped other church brethren. And after school, we would. So for a number of years, I helped Brother Robert Miller, and he laid brick on new homes. And so I mixed mud for him and laid brick. It was a tremendous experience working with Brother Robert Miller. Then when I was ordained minister, I was ordained to take Robert's place. And, I knew something about the man because I had helped him. I mixed mud for him. And, there was one of the occasions where I realized that godly men also have passions. Because there was a few times that Robert got really upset at neighbor boys that were messing up the work site. And to watch him control that anger, I knew how much it stirred him. And to be a saint when he chased that boy away left an impression. Because I think I'd have done something a lot more harsh than he did. And so, working in homes, helping folks, children, with children or with chores. And yes, it's nice when there can be some financial compensation, but one of the problems that we have in life is we think we need to be paid for everything. And it's just wonderful. It's wonderful if the folks who need some help say, I want to give you a little something. But the person going and helping says, look, I just want to help you and bless you. That makes a wonderful experience. And there's so many things you can learn. There's a number of things in trades that I learned because as a youth, I worked for others. And different men taught me different things. And so when it comes to fixing something around the house, sometimes, I just get at it and do it. And my wife says, where'd you learn that? Well, I picked it up here. Tremendous blessing. Could you pay for that with money? Not really. It's experience and it's a blessing. And so this whole idea of adults and youth working together and learning things, even things like work skills and how to do things. Number five, another way we combat this is Bible school experience. A good Bible school experience. A studious atmosphere where classes are a blessing. Teachers and administrators building relationships with youth. And a part of this subject is the subject of history. I think it's important that at some places we have opportunity for all of us to learn something from history. How did it work? The Russian Mennonites, the things that they went through. There's lessons there that we need to learn. And it may help us to avoid something that we're facing today. Again, on this Bible school experience, I believe it's a place where youth should be able to have their questions answered. It's not a place to question everything and leave questions hanging. No, it's not a place for a spirit of, we're going to corner this preacher or this teacher. We're going to, everything is suspect and everything needs to be, no, but they need answers. And we need to be men and women who have given some, who know what we believe and why we believe it. And we need to beseech God that we would be able in some way to put it in words for them. I recently preached a message about appreciating or understanding disciplined church life. And it's teaching about why we have a written standard. And a young married man came to me and said, I never heard a message about why a written standard. Well, we face challenges. Time moves on. I thought I knew why we have it. And as I studied, and shared, then some other people added some more things. We need to be able to put these things into words, brothers and sisters. It's easy for us to say sometimes, well, the next generation doesn't get it. They don't understand this. Well, I asked the question, did we ever teach them? Did we put some effort into trying to put it into words and help them to understand it? They need that. But we need this openness to discuss it, and we need this openness to talk about it and look at those questions. Number six, another place that this gap is pushed back against is youth activities under parental supervision. Young people enjoy doing things. And they like sometimes to go do some sightseeing. That's a wonderful thing when parents or adults in the church, maybe it's a couple that wasn't blessed with children and they love to do something with the youth. That's a wonderful opportunity to plan something, get the youth together. Maybe it's a project that the youth can help in. Maybe it's an older person's property and it ought to be mulched and flower beds cleaned up and the older ones can arrange it and the young people can enjoy the day together. And there, some of the generational gap is crossed. And I think about that in relation to cleanup work after floods and relief work like that. There's something tremendous about adults and youth alike sacrificing a day or 2 days or a week, leaving work behind and going and giving them your time and doing something good for somebody else and laboring together and learning to know each other in that way. Well, number 7 and the last point is, I believe that church life that involves the younger in decision making. Church life that involves the younger. They're along in looking at subjects. Whether it's men's meetings or members' meetings. But for sure in the ministry. It's a wonderful thing happens. It's a wonderful thing happens when the younger are along with talking about something. I remember in classroom experience, I remember a young girl started teaching and she thought she was certain that if you were the right teacher, and this was about a fourth grade level, I'm going to say, fifth grade level maybe. She was certain that if you were a nice enough teacher, you would never have to use correction like the rod. She was certain. And it was a big thing in her mind that she can do it with teaching and not with discipline. And God saw fit that she had a challenging bunch of students. And I didn't tackle it head on and melt it down and say, listen, you're going to, yeah. I just left her have her theory. But I would drop a line here and there that, you know, I believe you're going to have to use a little bit more firmness. And maybe it's not a spanking, but maybe it's something that bites a little. And no, she tried. And at some point, partway through the year, I just kept line upon line encouraging that what's happening is they don't believe that you'll ever bite. They don't believe that there'll ever be a cost. And they believe that it'll always be talk. And some of them enjoy the ride of seeing what the teacher will say next. And you're going to have to bring an end to it with something that says that doesn't happen in my classroom. And so one day she came over to the office and she was telling the story. I said, you know what? I believe you're going to need to take those two boys and paddle them. I will pray for you that God gives you courage, but you'll need to go do that. And she did. And it was wonderful to watch the weeks after that when she saw the change that happened in the classroom. When that classroom realized that this teacher will spank, something happened. And she got some control. And after a while, her tune changed, and she started talking about the value of taking care of the worst situations with that kind of discipline. Then it puts authority in the rest of your voice that she didn't have before. And she learned it because she had the opportunity to do it. She had to walk through that valley herself. She had to try her faulty theory, and took a pretty much patience on my part because I knew what the answer was that she wasn't willing to reckon with. And eventually she learned the answer herself. And so church life that involves the younger in decision making and in working through things and carrying the weight and realizing that we're going to need to make this work. So what does it mean? And that helps pull together. I believe that the older men should be there to help offer wise counsel. As a younger man, maybe understand some of the current issues. And I think about the subject of this artificial intelligence, AI. And I don't know where all that will go. And I don't even know what to think about it. But there's a lot of younger men who know a lot more about that than I do. And there's sometimes in church life when something new like that's on the horizon, we older generation tend to say, nope, we're not going there. We're not discussing it because And maybe we freeze something and we're not going to have this discussion. And really what we should do is we should talk about it while the old men have the wisdom to speak into it, while the young men know some of this current thing is happening, and get those two sides together and start talking about and find our way. What should we do? And sometimes, you know, we take a position and then something changes, and you may need to change that, because this stuff it's not static. It's constantly changing. It doesn't stay the same. Church life that involves the younger in decisions. But it's a snare for us older ones. And I'm not that old, but I'll stand with you older ones and take this, be a part of this, because it happens to me. It's a snare for us to whine about the younger generation not getting it, fussing that they're not what we were when we were young. But one thing we must remember is that we raised this generation. One of the things that young people can hardly stand is when their daddies and their grandpas act like there's something so terribly wrong, and they grew up in our homes and they grew up in our churches. We raised this generation. And I think that as older ones, we should be asking the question, so what is it about what we're doing that has set the stage for our young people to be here if they're at a place that we wish they weren't? What did we do that allowed that? What can we learn from that? And I think it'd be good to have them in that discussion as well, because they could probably tell us what we did that helped them to that position. And when our youth, when the next generation sees that the older ones are this flat out honest with truth and what's happening, saying, we don't always have it right. God help us. What can we do to do better? And not pushing blame on the next generation, but taking our own blame for where we, and saying, how can we redeem this situation? There's a bond that happens between the young and the old, because they see there's a future that we can work together. It's not all one-sided. Remember that we raised this generation. Well, in closing, I'd like to go to Psalm 144. Some beautiful verses. That is my prayer for all of our churches. Psalm 144, starting at verse 11. He says, rid me and deliver me from the hand of strange children, whose mouth speaketh vanity and their right hand is a right hand of falsehood. That's a youth group that you don't want. That's a generation that you don't want plaguing this congregation. Deliver us from that. But this is what we want, that our sons may be as plants grown up in their youth, that our daughters may be as cornerstones polished after the similitude of a palace, that our garners may be full, affording all manners of store, that our sheep may bring thousands and ten thousands in our street, that our oxen may be strong to labor, that there be no breaking in nor going out, that there be no complaining in our streets. Happy is that people that is in such a case, yea, happy is that people whose God is the Lord. I'm going to tell you something tonight. You can have verse 13 and 14 strong in your experience, but be missing verse 12, and you don't have anything. I know some homes where the father's successful in business, and he has oxen, he has sheep, he has cattle, but he lost his children and his grandchildren. And it's a weariness to the flesh. Tonight, I believe that if we have verse 12, if we are able to minister to the rising generation, and we can have a strength, we can have verse 12, then the sheep can die and the oxen can be, we can face a lot of tests on that end if we have the souls of our family with us. May God help us tonight to be able to live in such a way that crosses the gap, pulls the generations together, preserves the faith from one generation to the next. While life changes and many things change in society, but that the faith would be kept. May God bless us to that end.